Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a profile of the latest rising star in the Republican presidential primaries, Rick Santorum. Dr. Terry Madonna, the founder of the Keystone Poll and an expert on Pennsylvania politics, joins us. He has closely followed Rick Santorum's political career for decades, and we will try to assess Santorum's chances of becoming the nominee, as well as his aggressive stance on social issues, where he has not only crusaded against gay marriage and abortion, but also opposes contraception. Then, with the president making a rare appearance at the Pentagon today, where he presented a new defense strategic review and announced the tide of war is receding, we will get an analysis of what a leaner U.S. military might look like from Winslow Wheeler, who has worked on national security issues for 31 years as a senior Senate staffer and at the General Accounting Office. He is now the director of the Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information and is the author of Wastrels of Defense, How Congress Sabotages U.S. Security. Then finally, with the president's recess appointment of Richard Cordray, we will examine what is behind Republican attempts to block a new head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau from assuming his office. The author of Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business, joins us. Gary Rivlin is a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and he will explain why the Republicans are protecting payday lenders, mortgage companies, debt collectors, and other predators. Joining us now is Dr. Terry Madonna, a professor of public affairs and director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, where he directs the Franklin and Marshall College Poll. He has written extensively about voters and voting behavior and founded the Keystone Poll in 1992, the oldest survey produced exclusively in Pennsylvania, which was renamed the Franklin and Marshall College Poll. He is the pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Terry Madonna.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And the surprising rise of Rick Santorum must be having some ripples in the home state, because back in 2006, the voters in Pennsylvania soundly defeated him by, what, an 18-point margin?
Yeah, that's exactly the current U.S. Senator. One of our current U.S. Senators, Bob Casey, defeated Santorum in 2006. And what was not arguably a wave election, you know, that was the election in which the Democrats stormed back into control in Congress. And Santorum was soundly defeated, in part because of the wave worked against his party, and because there were some other issues that came up during the course of the campaign. But to go back to your original question, I mean, most Pennsylvanians, at least those that I've talked with, lots of reporters and lots of people just on the street from radio conversations that I had with them, are stunned. That's the only word you can use, stunned. You know, in 2006, the guy was put out of work, you know, in a sense, put out of his job in Washington. And now he's one of the top-tier candidates to become the Republican candidate for the presidency of the United States.
And as a conservative Republican, I detect a certain irony in looking at his biography, that he's never had a job in the private sector.
That's exactly right.
He's always, even though he got a law degree and went to a business school after going to Penn State University, his entire working life has been in politics.
That's exactly right. And when I first met him in the 1980s, he was working for a member of the state Senate in Pennsylvania, and then went on to law school, which he acquired going part-time in the evenings, moved to Pittsburgh after his law degree was completed, and then in 1990 ran for Congress and won in his first outing in 1990.
So what is the, I mean, we could talk about Terry Madonna about his chances in a little bit, but I'm just trying to get an understanding of what makes him tick. He's done well in Iowa because he is an authentic person.
You're exactly right. I mean, for all the criticisms that get hurled at him by Democrats and some folks in the media, there isn't any doubt that that he is principled and that he's focused and has a firm belief in what's right and wrong and what should be done based on, oftentimes, he's said, his moral values and his religion, which is a practicing Roman Catholic. So there isn't any doubt about that. And he's a real believer in the things that he fights for and the things that he opposes.
And I suppose the contrast there with Romney is that a lot of people don't buy Romney's act. He just doesn't feel authentic.
Right. Yeah, well, the way to think about that is, I mean, he's also maybe the luckiest guy in the world, because each of four candidates for the presidency on the Republican side had their moment in the sun, burst on the scene like a meteorite, and then was replaced about 6 or 7 weeks later by another rising star, soon to be Burt. You know where I'm heading with this. You've got Bachman, then you had the rise of Perry, then you had Herman Cain, then you had Newt Gingrich. And so how fortuitous was it when those other four candidates, candidacies, I won't say went up in flames, but developed very serious problems, so that Santorum became the last person standing among the social conservatives, among the Tea Party activists. And it was just fortuitous in the sense that they had all gotten themselves into one bad situation or another, one developed one problem or another, and Santorum was the beneficiary of that.
Well, it also indicates, though, surely, Dr. Terry Madonna, that the Republican voters are restless and undecided, and they're not happy with the front runner. They're casting about.
There's no doubt about that. I mean, the way I think about this is that, you know, there's been tremendous change in the landscape since 2006. And one of the important things about that is that a guy like Santorum has this fixed set of views, very firm and very committed to him. So a lot of people that may not normally say, I'm going to vote for him, like the fact that he is consistent. And on the questions of debts and deficits and social conservatism, he's been there for much of his political career. And so it would only be natural that as these other candidates came and fell, that he would be there to pick up support among social conservatives, Tea Party activists, fiscal conservatives, because the Republicans are looking for sort of the dream candidate. You know, they're dreaming about going on their first date, and you want the perfect candidate with all of the prerequisites that entails. But unlike, that's not the way the real world of politics like. I mean, it is. Most politicians have feet of clay at some point.
Again, I'm speaking to Dr. Terry Madonna, who's a professor of public affairs and director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, where he directs the Franklin and Marshall College poll. He's also a pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania, and has followed the career of Rick Santorum for 30 years now. Now, let's just turn to the implications of a man like him becoming president, because he does come across almost as a scold, something out of the Puritan past, you know, the scarlet letter types.
Right.
I have no problem with people being religious or even zealously religious, but when they impose their religion on others, or their, you know, impossibly high standards. I mean, he's not just against abortion and gay marriage; he's against contraception.
That's right.
This is just feels like. He doesn't have a snowball's chance. Prayer in hell,
in a place below, right?
Right.
So yeah, I can't disagree with that. I mean, in Pennsylvania, we got to know him pretty well, obviously, because he served 12 years as a United States Senator. I point out, you know, he's not been full throated champion of the party, but he did very early in his career, you know, insinuate himself into Republican politics, and certainly made that another way in which he got himself elected twice. But having said all of that, I find it hard to believe that he would ultimately become the nominee. I've been convinced all along, maybe I'm on another planet, that Romney would be the nominee. He's got all the money in the world to run. Santorum has very little, although he picked up $1 million in the last 24 hours. Romney has a good organization. Santorum has very little. So when you take a look at those two big ingredients, you have to wonder if Santorum can hold out. Now, here's how he does get help. Bachmann is now out of the race. True, she doesn't have a huge cadre of support. But if the majority of them would go to Santorum, then when Rick Perry gets out, you see where I'm heading with this. He becomes the beneficiary of the conservatives.
But Perry's not behaving according to the script. It's very puzzling to figure out what his motivations are.
He's staying in South Carolina.
His big supporters down there, a couple of wealthy Texas ranchers, are hosting a meeting with Gary Bauer, the former presidential candidate, the Reverend Wildman, and Dobson. The purpose of this meeting is to find an alternative to Romney.
Perry, as you point out, is not campaigning, withdrew from the campaign in New Hampshire, but will stay in to South Carolina. But in the next couple of weeks, as these candidates fall by the wayside, Santorum would normally be expected to pick up their support because they come from the wing of the Republican Party, the Tea Party, the social conservatives, the Christian evangelicals. And I think that's what I meant when I said he would be the beneficiary of it unless they could find someone else to move into the vacuum that conceivably could be created.
Well, it doesn't look like they will at this late stage. They may have to, and I'm wondering what Perry's motives are to be a spoiler in that regard, unless, of course, he thinks that Romney's going to give him a cabinet position because he doesn't even know what the government departments that he wants to ban.
But I will say this in general, as a political scientist, I've written a lot about parties and conventions. There's not a time, maybe since 1924, that we've seen this, I'm trying to figure out a word for it. It's not that the Republicans are in a horrific state organizationally. It's not that they don't have any money, but the fluidity surrounding this race, how unsettled Republican voters are in this race. I mean, we've not seen that combination of factors in a Republican contest since maybe before the Civil War, which makes this all unique and why most of us have been wrong every time we make a projection. Every time we make a prediction, the next day we find out, that one didn't work out so well.
So when you were saying earlier, Dr. Terry Madonna, Professor of Public Affairs and Director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, where he directs the French Franklin Marshall College poll. He also is the pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. When you said the people in Pennsylvania are just stunned that their former senator is now suddenly a serious contender for the Republican nomination for president, what is in terms of his home life, if you will? Yeah. He's got seven children, I believe. Disabled 3-year-old daughter, and of course there was a flap over the miscarried child who took home the body, and Alan Combs got into all kinds of trouble on Fox for making references to how strange that was, but he did get into trouble, didn't he, over disclosures that he was homeschooling his children
at his
family residence in Virginia, and yet he was charging the state of Pennsylvania's school district to enroll him in a cyber school. So what, isn't homeschooling, I know it's quite common, but it does seem to be an assumption that your children are too precious to face the corrupt and evil outside world.
Yeah, public schools, the corrupt public schools, yeah.
Right.
Well, I'll tell you something about that. That was a huge issue that Casey used. Bob Casey, the senior senator from Pennsylvania, who, by the way, is in his first term, got to be senior member, senior senator from the state already. Senator Casey used that issue against Santorum in 2006, that he, in effect, didn't live in the district. And then there was this business, as you point out, with the cyber charter school, and that the money to pay for that came from the school district back in Allegheny County, where Santorum had a residence, actually has a residence there. But the fact is that he wasn't living, you know, he's basically living in Washington, as you point out. Now, here's one point. The irony was that when he ran against Doug Walgren in 1990, his first election, he made the very same argument against Walgren, that Walgren, in for 14 terms, had completely withdrawn from his district and was an absentee congressman. So what's funny to me, ironic to me, is he had used that very same argument to defeat Doug Walgren in 1990. Why wouldn't Casey then use it against him when he was doing the very same thing in 2006?
Well, but what do you know about him, though, as a person? Because I can't understand why people, and they know him, and I don't know him, so I'm taking their word for it, that he is a kind of compassionate conservative, that he has. But on the other hand, he's a hate monger in terms of being against gays and gay marriage, and he refers to how single-parent homes have spawned poverty. And government intervention, that's hardly compassionate. I mean, people don't choose to be single parents. It usually happens by unfortunate happenstance.
You appropriately bring this up. I mean, I've never heard of him described as a compassionate conservative, actually. And he does have these very strong feelings about them. But I almost think it's the way he expresses them and what he would like to do as an alternative to them. You know, there are a lot of public officials around the country who are pro-life, but they don't, they don't refer to the other side as virtually being against Christianity, you know what I mean, or against, and seek harsh penalties for those who would violate the norm. And Pennsylvanians, I think, had grown a little weary of that, by the way, in the run-up to 2006 when he lost his seat to a state treasurer, Bob Casey, who's now our senior U.S. senator. But I think you're right about that.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Terry Madonna.
It's been my pleasure. Have a good evening.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Terry Madonna, who's a professor of public affairs and director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, where he directs the Franklin and Marshall College poll. He's written extensively about voters and voting behavior and founded the Keystone Poll in 1992, the oldest survey produced exclusively in Pennsylvania, and he's the pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the president showed up at the Pentagon today and said the tide of war is receding. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Winslow Wheeler, who has worked on national security issues for 31 years for members of the U.S. Senate and for the U.S. General Accounting Office. In 2002, he authored an essay under the pseudonym Spartacus about Congress's reaction to the September 11th terrorist attacks, which led senators to ask for his resignation from the Republican staff of the Senate Budget Committee. He is now a senior fellow and director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information and the author of The Wastrels of Defense, How Congress Sabotages U.S. Security and The Pentagon Labyrinth, 10 Short Essays to Help You Through It, available at the Center for Defense Information and online at Amazon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Winslow Wheeler.
It's my privilege. Thanks very much.
And the president today, in a rare appearance at the Pentagon, in announcing his new strategic review, said that the tide of war is receding. I guess the president hasn't been watching the Republican debates because they're all falling over each other to be the first to bomb Iran.
Right. I think it's exactly right to point that out first thing about what he said today. The words he used that I heard were, the wars of the last decade are over. And he's drawing a stark difference between himself and the lurid rhetoric we're hearing from all of the Republican candidates, except for Ron Paul. And you have to think that that's a major campaign theme that we're going to hear next year, analogous to 1964. You can have these wild-eyed guys who want to run around getting us in still more fights that we can't finish, or me. And I was, frankly, very glad to hear that. I suspect that means he's going to try to stick to his guns on getting the heck out of Afghanistan, albeit late, but by 2014. And I think that's a positive development. That's the one positive development I pulled out of the press conferences this morning.
Well, already, of course, the president's announcements have been met with scorn from the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Buck McKeon, who says that it is a retreat from the world in the guise of a new strategy. So given the president's efforts to cut $450 billion from the Pentagon, then you'd have to add another $500 billion to that if Congress fails to agree on its deficit reduction plan following the debt ceiling deal in August. The Republicans could have some grist for the mill, surely, in terms of weakening defense.
Well, he's going to frame it differently. What's going on in the Pentagon budget is not cuts. There are reductions from previous plans for the future. There are increases from the Pentagon budget where it is this year and last year. As Obama pointed out in his part of the events this morning, under his plan for the next 5 years, the dollar amounts for the Pentagon are going to go up, not down. And he's going to smack that back right in the face of whomever the Republicans decide to nominate when they, start, foaming with this sort of delirious idea that if we spend more money, will make our defenses stronger. It's counterintuitive, but there's no evidence of that. For the past 10 years, we've added huge amounts of money to the non-war parts of our defense budget, almost $1 trillion in the so-called base Pentagon budget, not counting the additional monies for the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. With that additional $1 trillion, our Pentagon managers managed to make our forces smaller, older, and less trained. Except for the Army, which is essentially flat in terms of brigade combat teams, the Navy's battle force has shrunk by about 10%, and the Air Force's combat squadrons of fighters, fighter bombers, and long-range bombers has shrunk by 50%. It's not a smaller, newer force. It's a smaller, older force. Our major equipment is, on average, older than it was 10 years ago. And we spend less time training our forces. It's really incredible. And it's remarkable that the Republican plan or advocacy is to do more of this. Sadly, Obama is pretty oblivious to these negative trends, but at least he will be saying that, what cuts are you talking about? You know, my budget calls for increases.
Again, I'm speaking with Winslow Wheeler, who has worked on national security issues for 31 years for members of the U.S. Senate and for the U.S. General Accounting Office. He is now the director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information. Now, just let's get this straight, though, because I'm always astounded. We spend more on defense than I think everybody in the world combined at this point. Certainly,
it's almost that. A few years ago, it was that, but now it's about 46% of the rest of the world.
And you're saying that we seem to be spending more than ever, but we're getting less and less? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. We're at post-World War II highs in terms of spending. We have been at a post-World War II high since about 2006 or so. And our forces are much smaller than they were during the Cold War. You've heard a lot of talk about the so-called doomsday mechanism that would automatically exact cuts in the Pentagon budget next January if Congress doesn't do anything to prevent it. If those cuts did occur, as they probably will, they will return the Pentagon budget to $470 billion a year. That is not a valley in post-World War II spending. It's not a peak either, but it's about in the middle. It's notably significantly above the average spending we spent in inflation-adjusted dollars during the Cold War. If we go to that so-called doomsday level of spending, $470 billion a year, that would be about $40 billion above what we spent on average during the Cold War. And so it's not a puny budget. It's a budget very flush with money. It's a budget that would be about three times the size of the military budget of China, counting all their spending on military resources. It's a budget that is more than twice the defense budgets of China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and anybody else you want to list as a problem country. It's not a puny budget.
So what's happening with all this extra money then? I think it's about 2007 levels we'll be back to if the axe falls because of the sequestration deal. Where is all this extra money going to? That's what
it's
I don't
know. It's gone into cost growth, both for hardware and for people. In hardware, as measured by the General Government Accountability Office, back in the year 2000, we had about $50 billion of cost overruns in hardware programs. In 2008, the last time they measured it, it was about $300 billion of cost overruns in the hardware programs. We're spending more for hardware and getting less because the unit cost of hardware has gone through the ceiling. We've replaced $60 million F-15s with, get this, $400 million F-22s.
Which is a troubled aircraft, too, I understand.
Pardon me?
It's a troubled program.
A highly troubled program. We can talk about it if you want, but it's not the wonder weapon that you would expect for all that incredible amount of money for it. It's a big disappointment in terms of aerodynamic performance, and it relies on extraordinarily complex cost-driving technologies that in the past have failed as effective weapons for air-to-air combat, and its design is driven by this so-called stealth characteristic that reduces, does not eliminate, its radar signature in the presence of some radars at some angles. The design of the airplane paid a huge penalty to be so-called stealthy, which is a very limited tactical advantage. And we're finding out now that the stealth coating is not working so well, and it's not met its spec on radar cross-section. And throughout about 4 months of 2011, the airplane was grounded, every single one of them, because they had a somewhat mysterious problem with the oxygen supply for the pilots that they fully hasn't understood yet. The problems with that airplane go on and on. There's a
well, I lost a pilot up in Alaska because if the oxygen supply ran out.
Yes, the plane crashed basically because it cut off the pilot's oxygen. And there's an interesting, fascinating accident report the Air Force produced a couple months ago that explains that they really have a mystery on their hands. They really don't know what's going on. They've restored the F-22 to flight status, but they haven't gotten to the bottom of the problem.
And this is a 450... That's a $450 million accident.
$417 million per airplane.
Right. And they've been providing pilots and crew with oxygen since what, World War II, right?
Right.
It's pretty bizarre, isn't it?
It's also extraordinarily expensive to operate. According to Air Force data, it's about $55,000 per hour to operate that airplane.
Well, what about this other one that they've got that's also being bought in huge quantities, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter? I understand
right.
The new...
The good news is that the F-22 is a better airplane than the F-35. The F-35 is to put it simply, it's a failed design. It's even more complex than the F-22. They hoped for it to be affordable. It's not. Its current unit price is up to about $155 million per airplane, and that's going north, not south. Everybody is eyeballing the F-35 as a bill payer for some of these other programs that are in trouble also as we go forward into a period of modest rather than dramatic Pentagon budget growth. It has all kinds of problems, and we're only 20% through a flight test program, and that flight test program itself is inadequate. It will only test 20% or 17% of the airplane's performance characteristics. The rest will be, quote, validated, unquote, with computer modeling and, if you can believe it, desk studies. That program should have been canceled a long time ago. It should be canceled now. They're not going to, but they will stretch out the production, and that will make the annual cost for the purchases smaller. But in the long run, it'll make the program even more expensive because you're producing it at a less efficient rate. It's a real nightmare of a program.
And we'd be better off just extending the life of the existing aircraft that we have?
Absolutely. In some proponents' respects, the F-35 is a step backwards from airplanes like the A-10 and the F-16. It would be quite simple to put together a properly conceived program for a new air-to-air fighter and new air-to-ground bombers and new close-air support fighters like the A-10. You'd have to start from scratch, and the airplanes would have to be purpose-designed rather than these multi-role designs. And you'd have to engage in competition and fly before you buy, all basic principles that the F-35 violates.
So this really, I mean, it's mind-boggling to listen to what you're telling us, Winslow Wheeler. This goes way beyond the notion that a camel is a racehorse designed by a committee. It's just hard to believe. There's got to be some structural reason why the Pentagon and the military contracts come up with these amazing ways to waste the taxpayers' money and to end up with stuff that they're worse off with than they would have been if they would have stayed with what they already had in the inventory. I'm just astounded. I mean, why is the system so broken?
Well, it is bad by design. These programs don't turn out this way by accident. You have to work at it to make them as ill-conceived as they are. There's two things going on. One is that people in our defense infrastructure think that technology for technology's sake is something to develop rather than technology that fights, excuse me, that helps pilots and soldiers do what they have to do in combat. We're not doing the latter, we're doing the former. And we're also doing it in a way that enriches the participants, whether they be members of Congress or uniformed or civilian officials in the Pentagon, to say nothing of the contractors. It's a self-feeding process that we've evolved, and the F-35 is an extremely negative example of it, but sadly it's typical of how we do business on weapons development and production, and it's a very sad story.
And we haven't even got into the aspect of it, which is that these are programs that were essentially designed with the Cold War in mind, for air superiority fighting, you know, the Warsaw Pact. Are there any examples on the horizon where U.S. aircraft are getting dogfights with some other air force? I mean,
well, I take some difference with you. You always want to have a competent air-to-air fighter. You want to have a good air-to-ground delivery aircraft for supporting troops in the field. I have no problem with upgrading the systems we have. That can be done at a small fraction of the cost that we're paying for things like the F-22 and the F-35 if you do them right. But it takes great spine and courage in today's system and extraordinary skill to push through these systems when they're properly conceived of. We've done it. We did it with the F-16 and the A-10, but we studiously avoided those kinds of lessons, and we've designed airplanes, for example, not for simplicity and effectiveness, but instead we've designed them for complexity and cost. And it'll take great leadership to move us back to the kinds of thinking that got us the F-16 and the A-10. Very sadly, we don't have that kind of leadership today.
But it is, the reason we're talking a lot about these two systems is that this is a zero-sum game, isn't it, the money that's available? And there's going to be less of it. I mean, what the president said today and Panetta at the Pentagon is that, you know, we've got to get our domestic house in order, and we just don't have this kind of money to throw around.
That's right, and this is just the first set of reductions that the Pentagon is going to be experiencing. I fully expect that after the elections, at the end of this year, no matter who is president, they're going to be faced with a situation both inside the Pentagon and the federal government in general that means that we're going to be spending less on the Pentagon, and we'll return to historic norms in terms of spending. What that means is that, you know, the business as usual types will scream bloody murder. But that will be an economic necessity for the United States to get all of its spending under control. The Pentagon is not a good jobs engine at all. And I think President Obama has acknowledged, and part of our political system has acknowledged, that our taste for these misadventures, these wars in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and Yemen and Somalia, is not something the American population has any more patience for. So I think we're going to see a very different environment in the coming years, both in terms of our international behavior and in terms of our Pentagon budget. Right now, we don't have the leadership that can cope with that, and we better find it pretty soon.
Well, just in closing, what about the people inside the Pentagon? If the Air Force is getting the lion's share of all this money and coming up with useless systems that don't work and cost record amounts of money, if you can't have the political leadership you're calling for, or people that are capable of getting the taxpayer some value for money, some pressure is going to come from within the military itself, the competing services.
Well, yeah, the armed forces are not a monolith. There's lots of people inside the Pentagon that are very concerned about both the wars and the prospect of another war with Iran, and about how we buy weapons and who are the people who benefit from this, you know, this system. There are lots of individuals of character and intellect in the Pentagon that understand the negative things that are going on. What they need is some leadership that permits them to articulate their concerns and to talk about solutions to some of these problems that that are, you know, maybe not difficult to think of, but very difficult to implement.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Winslow Wheeler.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Winslow Wheeler, who has worked on national security issues for 31 years for members of the U.S. Senate and for the U.S. General Accounting Office. In 2002, he authored an essay under the pseudonym Spartacus about Congress's reaction to the September 11th terrorist attacks, which led senators to ask for his resignation from the Republican staff of the Senate Budget Committee. He is now a senior fellow and director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information and the author of The Wastrels of Defense, How Congress Sabotaged U.S. Security, and The Pentagon Labyrinth, 10 Short Essays to Help You Through It. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about why the Republicans have been blocking the appointment of the president's new head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
There's no blankets for the winter. Propagate your lie, 'cause the working poor you've been on are doing double shifts tonight. What good, what good?
The union boys are there to protect us from all the corporate type. While curious George's drug patrol is out. You know I ain't no clown, 'cause these damn blue-collar tweakers are the backbone of this town.
And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gary Rivlin, a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. He is the author of five books, including Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business. He has worked as a staff reporter for The New York Times, where his beats included Silicon Valley and New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gary Rivlin.
Thanks, Ian.
And there is obviously a subtext to the Richard Cordray story here, in as much as it's, first of all, Elizabeth Warren was blocked from heading up the agency that she created, the Bureau, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that came out of the Dodd-Frank Act. The president's now been forced to give Richard Cordray a recess appointment, which has already upset the Republicans. But isn't the real truth to the matter is that as long as Cordray wasn't in heading up this office could not act on its mandate to oversee mortgage companies, payday lenders, and debt collectors, among others. Is that that's the
right? It was a really strange circumstance for a few months there, because the agency went live in July, and while it could still monitor the behavior of banks, it couldn't use the rulemaking power that Congress and the president invested in it. So it was an agency. It was trying to do work, but the most important thing about it is that it has rulemaking power. If they think there's something wrong with the way debt collectors are going about their business, they could write new rules that change that. If they are upset, if they conclude, to use the language of Dodd-Frank, that the payday lenders are selling an unfair, deceptive, or abusive product, they could create rules to deal with that. But until there was a permanent executive director in Richard Cordray, they couldn't write any rules. For some reason, Congress, the way they wrote the legislation, said you have all this power, but until there's a director, you can't use that power.
So was this then a delaying tactic then to keep the director out so that they couldn't make the rules? Because they've made no bones about the fact that, in fact, the Republicans really seem to revile the Dodd-Frank Act.
And the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in particular. I mean, more to the point, the banks and the payday lenders and the debt collectors all revile the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and of course they've been big donors to the Republicans because the Republicans have been willing to take on this fight. You know, it's interesting because I think it was 44 Republican senators said that no matter who the nominee is, we don't care what that person's name is, as long as it has the powers that it has, we're going to refuse to consider that appointment. And in fact, it's exactly that. It was a delaying tactic. And, you know, to a certain extent, it's been successful despite this maneuver by the president. The according to the legislation, a director gets a five-year term. But as a recess appointment, which is what Richard Cordray is, he's only going to be able to serve through the end of this term for the president. I mean, I guess Obama, if he's reelected, can re-up him. But instead of a five-year term, he's essentially getting a one-year term. But, you know, the president was boxed in that, you know, our system says that, you know, 40 senators can hold things up, that even though the Senate could approve Cordray, they would have the power to hold it up with the threat of
The filibuster.
That's not
our system. That's a reinterpretation of our system that relatively recently by the Republicans in the Senate.
Though in fairness, the Democrats used it under Bush as well. But yes, it's a recent version. You don't even have to filibuster anymore. You just have to say, Mr. Smith goes to Washington. No one actually has to stand up and hold forth.
And Cordray,
you have to threaten it, and that's good enough.
Right. And Cordray actually got 54 votes he was approved by the Senate, but it's not the magical 60.
Exactly.
So I'm trying to figure out here where the support. I mean, first of all, you have to ask yourself, surely, Gary Rivlin, what happened to the short-term memory of this country? It was only back in 2008 that we had the subprime bubble that was directly related to deregulation on Wall Street. We've also seen how the five-member commission that oversees the futures market, the consumer. CTFC, whatever it's called.
Mr. Gensler from Goldman Sachs and Company, yes.
Right, and the reason the Republicans want a commission instead of a bureau is that they've been effectively able to stymie the oversight over the gaming of the price of oil and food. The question would be is, why doesn't the president or somebody point out to the American people that, you know, you're getting screwed, both in terms of the cost of food, the cost of gasoline, and the cost of mortgages, and this could be really good for you. And the reason we're in trouble is not too much regulation, but too little.
Well, I mean, to me, that's one of the great mysteries of the last two or three years. If you ask me what happened, how did we come up with the subprime mortgage crisis? You know, how is subprime credit generally, whether it's payday loans, subprime mortgages, subprime credit cards, how did it get so out of hand and end up virtually taking down the global economy? I would have started explaining to you that it's 30 years of deregulation. Ever since the Reagan era, we deregulated mortgages. That started in 1980, 81, 82, and that led to countrywide AmeriQuest and these abusive subprime loans that had no basis in reality. The lending terms, it didn't make a difference if someone could pay it back because they were just going to securitize and sell it to Wall Street. I would have said that was purely because of deregulation, and yet you watch the Republican debates, you listen to the Republican talking points, and they say the problem with the Obama administration with Dodd-Frank is overregulation. I'm thinking, like, my God, are we looking at the same picture? In fact, I'm reading the new book by Thomas Frank, Pity the Billionaire, and it's about this very contradiction. How did this happen? How are we hearing that we need to deregulate after 30 years of deregulation caused calamity in the world economic market.
Well, but there is a sort of pattern that repeats itself, doesn't it? I mean, the my understanding is that there's also a bubble developing now in the student loan for-profit college racket that now Wall Street is getting into. But the weird part about these things is that that it's government money that's being loaned out in the case of student loans, and it's all being enabled through lobbyists. I mean, in other words, that the private for-profit colleges depend 90% on the government for their money, and they're making huge profits at the same time. And that's because of lobbying. What's the role of lobbying in keeping these payday lenders, these bottom feeders, in the mix?
Well, the Payday Lender Association, the various payday lenders, spend millions of dollars a year lobbying. But, you know, I do want to point out that, you know, the payday lenders, the debt collectors, all these other fringe financial operations, they lost. I mean, I think maybe that's what's most galling to me personally about these efforts to undermine the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau before it began. You know, these 44 Republican senators said, hey, it shouldn't be a single director, as you said, it should be a five-person board. They shouldn't have the independence of budget that they have. You know, the Republicans in Congress are saying, this is so irresponsible, they don't have to come before Congress for their funding. Well, that was deliberate. I'm sorry, you lost the fight during the last congressional session, and, you know, the consumers won. This is, you know, we might have disappointments with Dodd-Frank, but the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is a great thing, and if you read the blogs of the payday lenders and their, you know, their association, you know, that was a crushing loss for them. So I actually do have high hopes for this new agency, that they maybe can start to rein in the abuse, despite the lobbyists, despite the best efforts of the Republicans to undermine this bureau before it began. You know, it's just kind of like, what can they do? For those who don't know, a payday loan is a short-term loan that, if you express the rate they charge for this loan for 2 weeks, it comes out to an annual interest rate of 400%. Whoever wrote Dodd-Frank said that this new bureau does not have the right to create a usury cap. You cannot say, Richard Cordray cannot say, you know, any loan above 36% annual percentage rate is too high. He doesn't have that ability. But, you know, there's still a lot of room in the law to rein these folks in. What is abusive lending? You can't change the interest rate, but maybe you could say no more than 6 in a year, because to pay those kind of fees all year would be abusive. So, you know, it's going to be very interesting to me. You know, what do they do about debt collectors? I have a big feature in this week's Newsweek about debt collectors. I mean, the data is astonishing, that as much as people have always complained about debt collectors in these hard economic times, complaints about debt collectors to federal authorities has gone up 20%, 30% just over last year. So between 2009 and 2010, you know, the complaints that the federal government's getting about abusive debt collectors, using abusive language, using threat of violence, calling, you know, off hours, is very strict hours when they can and cannot call. And so, you know, I really feel like finally there's going to be an agency in our corner. And will they do everything we hope they do? No. But even if they help make mortgages more clear and fairer, even if they curtail payday lending without doing it in, even if they rein in debt collectors so there's less abuse, I think it's at least a step forward.
Well, that's what you would think, though, that that this would be something that could be championed, because I recall a while, not so long ago, because the debt collectors, the payday lenders, tend to prey on soldiers and vets, and the military, the brass in the Pentagon stepped in and had a law passed to keep them away from a military basis, because they were flocking around military bases like flies. You know, And you were mentioning the 400% interest rate, which would make the mafia blush. That's the part of it that I find so extraordinary, that members of Congress, and in particular the Republican Party, would be protecting people whose social function is so malignant.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There have been some conservatives who've spoken out against petty lenders. Even Adam Smith, I mean, you know, the hero of free market types, even Adam Smith in his writing spoke about the necessity for fair lending rates, that if there was abusive, if there's usurious lending, the free market wouldn't work. And so there are some true conservatives out there who do think this is above and beyond these kind of interest rates. And one thing I want to say is that a lot of people, like, look at whoever the appointment is to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and her name is not Elizabeth Warren. But, you know, the consumer groups are really high on Cordray. He was attorney general in Ohio right around the time of the subprime meltdown, and he was really good and really strong in taking off after the banks and other abusive mortgage lenders. So he has a track record. He is somebody that has the consumer groups feeling encouraged that, okay, it's not Elizabeth Warren, but this is somebody who's been fighting the fight and actually is more of a politician than Elizabeth Warren. She, of course, is running for Senate, so now she's a politician. But until that, she had never been in politics. So, you know, it's there's some disappointment it's not Elizabeth Warren, but, you know, by and large, the consumer champions are very pleased with it being Cordray.
Well, but it's worth noting, Gary, that Elizabeth Warren is doing very well as a politician, and she's very popular. And to the extent that Scott Brown, her Republican opponent, broke ranks of the Republicans and supported the appointment of Cordray. So maybe this is a winning issue.
Don't get me wrong. She's an astonishingly good politician. Yeah. I'm just saying she wasn't a practiced politician, and, you know, like Cordray. I'm paying a lot of attention to the Massachusetts race. It seems dead even between, you know, a guy who has a lot of political experience and, you know, Elizabeth Warren, who's a newcomer, at least to the electoral arena. I mean, I think what's beautiful about this is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was, in fact, her idea. Obama got the idea from Elizabeth Warren. He named her as the person to put it together, and so everyone could feel good about, like, okay, the architect put this thing together, and now I feel like you get kind of two for the price of one. She's the one who hired Cordray to oversee enforcement for the agency. It wasn't in the cards that she was going to get the executive directorship. She goes and runs for Senate, stands a pretty good chance, I would say, of winning the Massachusetts seat. And the person she appointed to a top position within the Bureau is now running it.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Gary Rivlin.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Gary Rivlin, a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. He's the author of five books, including Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business. He's worked also as a staff reporter for the New York Times. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday with at 11 with another Background Briefing. Until then, bye for now.